Hello everyone, and welcome to a special episode of the History of England podcast. I believe I have mentioned that in September of 2022, I was lucky enough to be with 28 folks from the land down under, from America and from Canada. And a great time we all had, or at least a great time I had. You'll have to talk to the rest about whether they had a good time. You are about to hear a session we all had in the Queen's Hotel in Cheltenham, when everyone was allowed to ask questions of Dr. Richard Grove and myself. We had a bit of a debate. As it happens, it was during the week of the Queen's funeral. So there's a bit of chat about the Queen. Also, I was asked about my podcast and what we're going to do, and then some general questions of critical historical interest, including stuff such as the biggest changing points in human history and which monarch you'd like to have at your side in a bar fight. You know, all the important stuff. Richard Grove, if you're wondering, is a friend of mine and an archaeologist, and he was kind enough to do a bit of tour guiding, especially at Kenilworth, where he did his doctoral research. This has a connection to what you're about to hear, actually, because I could not stop the bloke warbling on about stones in relation to heritage sites. That's his specialisation. Which is why, just so you know, everyone laughs when stones are mentioned. It's a bit of an in-joke you need to know about. Well, look, I hope you enjoy the chat and discussion. It was something of a blast, the tour, I have to say. So I suspect that with the following wind, I will do another one next year too. Watch this space. So I'll whiz you over now to the Queen's Hotel in Cheltenham back in September. So the sound quality will, of course, change. And I hope you enjoy it.
The main thing we are going to do is these are history questions, and these I might do my best to have my answer, and then we'll go around asking you for your answers, okay? Yes. You don't have to be everybody, you do not have to talk because you don't want to talk. You can sit here and just watch proceedings, because I've been self-conscious before, I know what hell they are if you have to answer to this. So you can say nothing and you've done your job. Okay? There's no pressure. You're on holiday after all, apparently. So, really nice question at the beginning on the weirdest health beauty thing. You might have some things. If you don't, that's fine. And then finally, what are the big moments of events that change history? I think it'd be nice if you focused on that one, because that's a nice big question which the History of England listeners can solve. Okay? So, that's what we're doing. Richard, are you going to interview me? We've only got one thing now.
Yeah, it's fine. I can shout.
You can check. Come on, let me get this.
Shall I come and sit down? I need to do my Michael Parkinson routine.
You do your Michael Parkinson.
What questions do you have to ask me, Richard?
David.
Yes, Richard.
It's delightful to join you in this.
How lovely.
In this Regency setting.
Yes, isn't it?
It's a shame all these people are here eavesdropping.
It is.
It's going to make the round expensive.
It is. Who's buying a round? Anyway, let's get on with it. We've got to finish sometime before the end of the day, all right?
Yeah. David.
Yes.
I'd like to start by asking you what prompted you to start this momentous podcast.
What an interesting question, Richard.
Yes.
So I think I'm bored everywhere. The answer is really boring. I had a job where I was either had no time because we were doing a tender, or I had loads of time, and I started off by making small plastic aeroplanes for my children because they were little. So I was bored because I had this time on my hands sometimes, and I heard Mike Duncan. Yeah, we all loved it.
Mike!
Who does not love Mike Duncan? I mean, you know, everybody loves Mike Duncan. So I said, I can do that. And so I started to realize that I couldn't do it, but I thought my mum would listen, at least. Actually, she never did. She did listen to me once. The only time she listened to me, she phoned me up and she said, David, I've got this problem. And I could hear my voice in the background. I said, what's the problem, Mum? You're listening to my podcast. Great. Yes, that's why I'm phoning you. I can't turn it off. Charming. Anyway, so that's why I started it, just thought it would be a bit of fun. Have you got another question for me, Richard?
Yeah. I mean, leading on from that, do you have any idea when you might conclude?
1913. Next question.
Yeah. So,
I decided I'd love to get into doing in Victorian times and in the early 20th century, you get a lot of social reforms and society changes a lot. And those social reforms are very interesting. So we start a pension scheme, for example, things like that. And the whole attitude that you've got now in early modern Europe towards the poor and towards community transforms in the 18th century and the beginning of the 20th, 19th century. So I really couldn't bear not to do that. But I really don't want to do the First World War and the Second World War, because how many podcasts are there on a scale of 1 to 10 on the First World War and Second World War? I mean, several billion out of 10? If that's a good... So I don't think any of the world needs another one. So I'm going to stop in 1913.
And what are you going to do afterwards? What's next?
I don't know. Anybody's any suggestions?
How about War on the Wall?
You're fired. Any suggestions what else I should do?
History of Wales.
It's really tempting. It is really tempting because they've got it's a fantastic history. Yeah, and also, I'm English. So they'll hate it as much as they hate me doing a history of Scotland. But it is a nice suggestion. Might do it.
Geology, stones.
Richard, would you like to do a podcast on geology and stones?
I'd love to, David. Thanks for having me.
Excellent. Thank you. Well, let me know how it goes.
Can I use the shed on Mondays?
You can use the shed on Mondays and you can have the office chair on Wednesday afternoon. Well, actually, you're doing a podcast, aren't you?
Yes, we're recording it now.
Right. What is your podcast on? Do I have to relay this to the people at the back?
Yeah.
Richard is going to do a podcast.
Yeah, right.
You're committed now. This has got you in trouble. And what are you going to do a podcast on?
So it's not me on my own. It's with my partner, Willow, under the banner of The Living Past. And the first series is going to be mapping the course of the River Avon from where it rises in Naseby, through Stratford, where we were earlier, down to Chooksbury, where it joins the Severn, and we're going to plot the history that happens alongside it, some of the major social events, some of the landscape, lots of the geology, archaeology, some poetry. Willow's an artist, so there's going to be art that goes with it. So it's going to be a smorgasbord.
Sounds great.
And three people are going to listen to it.
Right.
One of them, already confirmed, is your mother.
Oh, I'll be having words with her then.
Thanks,
Mark.
So it's called the Living Past Podcast.
And what's your last name?
Grove.
Richard Grove.
Richard's got some very...
Richard Stone, I thought.
Richard's got some very good labels, actually. You're called the Grove Digger, aren't you? Is that your... And International Man of Prehistory?
Yes, that's right.
That's very good. But they were very funny. Anyway, do you have another question? Oh, no, I was supposed to say what else I might do. The other thing I would love to do, which categorically nobody will ever listen to, is a regional history of England, because England is divided into a number of different regions, which until modern times were very much interconnected. And essentially, if you're an East, live in East Anglia, even now, if you towed the rest of Britain into the middle of the Atlantic and sank it, they would not notice. You know, seriously, I'm saying, you know. So I'd love to get a whole lot of podcasters together, but it's an enormous amount of work and it will categorically never happen. But, you know, that's what I'd really like to do. Maybe one day. Do you have another question for me, Richard?
Yeah. You did have a series on Roman Britain. Have you got any interest in pre-Roman?
I would, because when I was a lad, my dad said to talk to me very mysteriously about the first inhabitants of the British Isles, and he called them the Beaker people. Do anybody know anything about the Beaker people?
Yeah.
You do? Catherine Curran do. So I thought I'd do a history of the Beaker people. So I thought I might do it. Okay. Then we can do the Celts.
People like San Francisco poets?
Do you have Beaker people?
No, she's saying beats.
Yeah.
I see the Beaker people. That would be another good podcast.
I could take you to show you a person because I've excavated one just up the road here.
We could do it together.
Yeah.
Has it got anything to do with sandstone?
No, it was in clay.
Great. Well,
it was in clay, should I say.
We're still not doing it. Oh. Next question. Next question.
Honestly.
No, I promise. That would be great.
Yeah.
I'd love to do that together.
So, are you intending to the hot topic of you know, political discourse? Will you be covering colonialism and colonies?
I will. Oh, yes. Well, definitely be covering colonialism. So that's a really interesting question. I'm glad you've asked it, Richard.
Thank you.
And whoever it was, I'm glad you asked it. Because it's been killing me. How do I deal with... Because I cannot do the history of all the colonies in depth. I mean, my head would explode. So I've been worrying about it. And I have started with West Africa, because we had a few episodes on West Africa. But it occurs to me that what my job is to do is, although it's probably already been done several times, is talk about colonialism from an English viewpoint, because that is what I'm doing. But what I promise is that with each stage, the voice of the colonized will appear, because that's what's traditionally missing in, you know, Western view of colonialism. And also that I will start by framing it in terms of what the civilization was before the arrival. I mean, that can only be an overview, but at least we'll set it in that context. So that's the approach I'm thinking of taking. For good or ill. Is that it?
No, there's more.
Oh, God, they want to get to the bar.
I know, I've been feeling all fidgeting already. Yeah.
Although Leanne's going to go in and get Norm to bring us out all drinks.
Oh, God, I don't say his name. He's already afraid of me.
He speaks very highly of you. Yeah.
So, I mean, contemporary public figures.
Oh, God.
Who do you most admire?
The people I've really admired in my adult lifetime, very recent, this chap called Gareth Southgate. Gareth Southgate is the manager of the English football team. And I also admire the women's football team, because we had a European Cup this year, which was, for reasons I'll tell you, wildly popular. So Gareth Southgate did a letter to English. He created a team which came second in the European Cup, which is very good for England, because we haven't got anywhere near that good for a long time. And his team is very diverse, they're very young, they come from a range of different ethnic backgrounds. Many of them, like Marcus Rashford, for example, is a very rich footballer, but does a lot of public works. And he wrote a letter to the English, because actually for us, it's very difficult to talk about Englishness at the moment. Gareth Southgate is one of the heads of one of the few institutions which are genuinely only English. It's basically an English football team and the Church of England. And that's pretty much the only purely English institutions we have, unlike in Scotland and Wales. And so he spoke about being English and what it meant. And for that, I admire him very much, because he painted a very progressive, modern picture, rather than talking about empire or we used to be great or any of that kind of stuff. This is how we should be. And it was wonderful to listen to. And then the women's football team, because they won the European Cup. We have a terrible reputation in England for football hooliganism. It is in the past, but it still hangs around us. The entire tournament was packed out. It was a family occasion. The women's team, who were all very successful, loved everything they did and were incredibly enthusiastic. And it was just a wonderful feeling that brought all the fun back into English football. And, you know, it was just, you know, we had a ball.
I think the England rugby football union might have something to say about
not true, good point. Yeah, okay, yeah. I paraphrase.
I know cricket is England and Wales, so...
Yes, that's true. Anyway, sorry, Richard is quite pointing out that there probably are some other English institutions. Guilty as charged. But not many.
Not many.
No. And there's no English Parliament, for example.
No.
Anyway, should we move on? Because everybody's looking bored.
Should we talk about the Queen?
Should we talk about the Queen? Do you want to talk about the Queen, or are you sick to death of talking about the Queen? Talk about the Queen. Yes. You're sick to death. Lois, you come and talk about the Queen. So what was the first question? What will her legacy be?
Yeah, well, what will history make of her reign?
First of all, I think it depends on your perspective, where you come from. If you are Indian, you're much more likely to have a wider range of opinion. It's not always going to be negative, actually, but it's more likely there's going to be a much wider range of opinion that will include that negativity. So it does depend on your perspective. One of the problems is that people don't understand quite how apolitical the royal family is, and therefore talk about her as though she has an impact on policy, which in fact she does not. But first of all, she's a very effective politician. A bit like being in a football team, you can only beat who you come up against, then you can only be a politician within the parameters that you can work in. And within those parameters, she has provided a source of stability which has changed over time. She was born she was crowned as a child of empire. She will not die as a child of empire. She will die as a child of decolonization, in fact, because that is what's happened during her reign. In that also, I think she leaves a very positive legacy, although again, depending on where you are, where your perspective. Because she could have, although she couldn't have stopped decolonization, she could have formed a center of conservatism. You know, she could have formed a court which fought tooth and nail against the idea of decolonization, losing the empire. And you can imagine many monarchs that would have done that. And she never did that. actually the way she treated the Commonwealth was very positive. And very famously in 1961, she danced with the president of Ghana. South Africa was livid with her. Very famous, she was furious with Margaret Thatcher for not imposing sanctions on South Africa. She was very positive for against racism and for decolonization. And I think that's one of her very strong legacies. I don't know. I mean, I'm very interested to learn if anybody has any comments about what you think her legacy is. Does anybody want to disagree with that or add anything to it? Leanne.
Okay. I'm from across the pond, and I always thought Elizabeth was someone to be admired, of extreme character. She was a devout Christian, which was important to me. Mm. But I agree with you that she did not cling to empire. Mm. She was gracious interracially and letting the colonies become independent nations and independent entities. Mm-hmm. And she was happy to do it. Mm. She wasn't pushed into doing it. She was happy to do it because it was the right thing.
Yeah.
So she was awesome.
Good. Thank you. Anybody else want to?
Thank you. I grew up in Rhodesia. It was a British colony. And of course, it's Zimbabwe now. And I have seen the transformation of Rhodesia become, you know, we had sanctions imposed on us by England, but we became a self-sufficient country. But the British were such an enduring mark on the country. They were great administrators. Mm. And the systems that we had in place was due to the British. And I've just seen the collapse of Zimbabwe. Mm. I hate to say, you know, to say it, but it's just not what it used to be. Mm. And I attribute a lot of the development and the roads and just the infrastructure that, you know, made up Rhodesia due to the British. Mm. So, you know, for my part, I'm very grateful. I think the same with India. Of course, I didn't. Mm. I'm Indian, but didn't grow up in India. But a couple of times that I've been there, I have seen too the positive, you know, contributions that the British have made.
Thank you.
Thank you, Darren. So I served in the U.S. military, and something that always struck me when watching her is I saw someone who understood the concept of public service. And I couldn't find a better example of someone to look up to towards that regard. It's just inspirational to a lot of people, whether or not you're from the United Kingdom or abroad. That's an example of what public service looks like over an entire lifetime.
But she stood for duty. And it was very important to have that example, and it always has been. And I think actually, when we think about the next question, I think Charles will be very similar. The thing about the faith also is very important, because although she's formerly the head of the Church of England, you know, that we're not in a state anymore of, you know, persecution around religion, fortunately. And I think the fact that she is religious, it doesn't really matter that she's religious in a Christian sense, that it is Christianity, that is her chosen religion. The point is, for all the diverse communities we have, what is important for them, I believe, is that there is a head of state who believes that faith is important. You know, it's not something to be got rid of and to secularize. And even though she's not Islamic, or, you know, she's not Jewish, yet she will take those communities and their concern about any challenges to their faith. She will take that seriously. That is a very positive thing. Do we have any more questions, Richard?
No, that's it. I think we should go home now.
Okay, yeah. So thank you for coming. We got through the Queen yet, so the British Royal Family.
No, we're just getting started.
Okay.
So what about the abdication of Edward VIII?
Oh, that's a really hard question. Who asked that question? That was a really hard question. The question was, what would have happened, and you're definitely going to have to answer this one, okay, you lot. What would have happened if Edward VIII had not abdicated? Do you know the story of Edward VIII?
Yeah.
Right? Mrs. Simpson?
Wallace Simpson,
yeah. So I thought long and hard about this, and often cursed, actually, as I thought about it. I really don't know. I mean, the thing about Edward VIII was that as it turns out, he didn't have those principles of public service because he chose wrongly. He chose differently.
He was wrong.
Well, yes, you might. I understand why you say that. And he didn't do his duty. But also, he had quite a lot of messing around with Nazism, as I believe it. Yeah, well, I don't know if it would have had that much impact, but I doubt he would have had the cohesive force that George VI had, who was kind of above reproach and as somebody not in line to the throne that everybody sort of sympathised with, therefore, as a man who didn't want power and yet accepted it. It would have been much harder for Edward VIII to have then changed his spots and behaved in a different way and become a focus for... So I don't know that we'd be speaking German, but it would certainly have been... He would not have played the role, I think, that George VI did. Excellent. Good question. Yeah. Hard one, though. Easy questions next time.
I've got a nice easy question for you.
Have you?
Yeah.
What's the square root of 4,052?
16, I think.
Is it? Okay, got you. Carry on.
So, in your opinion...
Yes.
Yeah. And I mean, principally...
In my opinion, okay.
And solely your opinion, I'm not going to allow you to open this to the floor.
Okay.
Yeah. Do you think England has a greater focus on its own past?
That's a nasty question. I know who
asked. Is that a good or bad thing?
Right. I know who asked them that question and they're in trouble. I don't know really, because I don't really know what other countries think about their past, you know, how much they focus on it. I know that it's an issue for us, or that it's talked, not that it's an issue for us, that it's talked about a lot. And I have to say, my attitude towards history is A, that it's a lot of fun, B, that it's important to know other people's histories because you have to understand how they're viewing you. So if you don't understand that America, you know, are a bunch of rebels, frankly, and I think the word treason is probably appropriate here, I'm sure you'll all agree. But although, you know, you can't be treasonous because it worked, you know, so... No, but if you don't understand your history with other countries in particular, then how can you work with them in a sensitive and forward-looking way? So I do think it has that importance. It's important to know where you've come from, but it should not define you. I mean, sometimes I think we should just bury all of English history and forget about it, because the only responsibility we have is to create a better world. That's what's important, not what's happened in the past. I do think it's important you know where you've come from, but where you're going is much more important. And if it stops you from doing that, that becomes a real problem. Ellie, what does everybody else think? Oh, well, am I not allowed to throw that over?
No, you can do that, Ivan.
What about you? What do you think the answer to that question, Richard?
So I work quite a lot in mainland Europe, and I've spent an awful lot of time in Ireland. The Italians, Germans, and to a lesser extent the French, have a very, very strong sense of their history as being a historical thing. So from my perspective, from my work, I see that English historical narratives are more of a live thing. They inform today's decisions a lot more readily. Hmm. And I don't necessarily think that's always a good thing. On the flip side of our way of thinking, you spend any time in Ireland and you see this really forward-thinking society that is trying to completely remodel itself almost from ground zero. And I think a lot of the problems that Ireland has been able to overcome in the last 15 years post the big economic crash have been down to this forward focus. Mm. And they're not hung up on you know, what they used to be and what, you know, and obviously that's largely down to the fact that we've been utter swine swords in nearly 1,000 years. So, you know, but I can see why that mindset benefits them, and they do it without discarding the culture, and they're very proud of their history and their landscape and their stonework. But it's a very, very different thing. I mean, I think all of the sort of European cultures that I work with have got this very deep underlying identity that comes from this. But I think in England it is far closer to the surface, and sometimes that's not helpful.
Anybody got any comments?
Wow. As somebody who's sworn in of England in the last week, the chair's position You have a very beautiful country with a very beautiful history.
Thank you.
So it's easy to be harsh on it. Mm. So I think it's one thing to say it could be better versus to just cherish the history you have and then look forward and also appreciate the future you have as well. So all that to say, you're very British. You're stoked about your future, very angry and angsty about it. But, you know, look, you've got a beautiful Tewkesbury Abbey that we just looked at today. You should be cherishing that.
I mean, I couldn't agree more than that. I mean, I love it. I mean, you know, I can't get enough of it. It's just that it can get in the way, you know. I am 30 points. Anybody else want to comment, or should we move on?
Are we up to the knife fight yet?
No,
it's graduating.
Is that what you're waiting for, Lois?
We are.
Or, I mean, I'm just here for the knife fight.
Yeah.
Lois.
She's just here for the knife fight, and she's bought a gun.
Yeah.
Yes, we are actually up to the knife fight.
Haven't we got the one about health and beauty things? Because I love that question.
Well, that I think is somewhere else, because it's not on there. Well, yeah.
It's
further down the list.
Great.
Yeah.
So I have the question. What was the question, Richard?
The health and beauty question. Let me just have a minute to think about it.
Oh, come on.
So, David, what is the weirdest part of your health and beauty routine?
Oh, you know, I can categorically tell you I do not have a health and beauty regime.
I find that.
Shut up. Shut up.
I am standing in a glass house throwing stones here.
Yeah, well, that's true, yeah. So, look, I don't have a whole load of stuff on this, but there are two things that I loved that I came across when I'm doing the podcast. There's a chap called Daniel of Beccles who wrote the first courtesy book in English called The Book of the Civilized Man. And what it is a series of advice about how to deal with social hierarchy, how to deal with self-control in a social environment, and sexual morality. So it's kind of a how to behave type handbook, an etiquette handbook. And there are loads of these that follow. You know, in the 16th century in particular, the Italians go mad on books saying about how to behave and indeed how to get people into bed. I mean, seriously. So there's some lovely advice in this. And the bit of advice that I've really taken to heart and tried to emulate, if you go to your lord's house or you go to somebody else's house, you don't pee on the floor. Now, I don't know about you, but I think that's solid advice, don't you?
Solid.
However, if you're the owner of the house and you've invited people, then it's perfectly reasonable. Which, again, I think is solid advice.
Yeah,
absolutely. I mean, you know. That was a lovely bit of it. So that's a lovely book, and I'd recommend it to all of you, The Book of the Civilized Man by Daniel of Beccles. And then there's, on the health line, there's a leech book from the 10th century called Bald's Leech Book. And leech is a word for a doctor, and Bald was the guy who ordered it to be written. So it has, and actually, interesting enough, it has some notes written down the side. It's kind of a living document. People have taken it from generation to generation and written their own notes on it, and their own remedies. And one of them was from Patriarch Elias about a remedy that he'd given to Alfred. Because King Alfred had Crohn's disease, and they'd written to the patriarch, and he'd written back these ideas. It didn't work, obviously. There are recipes against night elves and against goblins, which I think is always handy, you know. And there was one particular one I got down here. So if a male impotence, there seems to be a lot of emphasis in all of this on male sexuality, doesn't there? Is that a surprise to us all? So agrimony. Does everybody know what agrimony is? It's a herb, okay? Agrimony is a herb. So apparently that's good for male impotence. So i.e., you know, a bit like, what's the, sorry? Viagra. Thank you, Lois. How did I know you'd know that? Well, so, but apparently if you put Welsh beer in it, then it works the other way around.
Oh.
Now, I don't know what the Welsh think about that, and I haven't consulted them, to be honest, but, you know, you can read that anyway. I mean, it's quite interesting how it's constructed. So there's substances, but there's also lots of holy work, water, and faith. You know, it is healing in a difference, in a holistic sense, in a way, that you've got to deal with the mind, faith, religion, as well as the physical attributes of what's wrong with you. So prayers is, what you know, is an important part of it. And then there was one, there's a cure for hangover.
Oh.
Okay, so you've,
thank God.
Have you got your notes? Yes, you're going to need this, Andy. Well, poor old Norm's going to need this tomorrow morning. So a cure for hangover is betony, which is, again, another herb, yeah? And 5 slices of roasted pig's lung. So I know that Richard does have some pig's lung on him, actually. So if you'd like some...
For tomorrow morning.
Tomorrow morning.
I've got enough for everybody.
And then on the beauty stuff, one turns to Elizabeth I in these situations, because Tracy Borman and Lucy Worsley have both written really good books about Elizabeth I and her, you know, her regime. And there's a really famous one about the fact that she puts white lead on her skin, which, of course... makes the skin look even more shrunken because it's poison, you know. But actually, the one I liked was, in actual fact, we see all these lovely pictures of Elizabeth, but of course, like many people in that time, her teeth were in an absolutely awful condition. And people, even if teeth didn't rot, when you ate bread, there was a lot of stone in the bread because of the grindstones. And so, you know, you did real damage to your teeth. So, sorry?
I did not know that.
There you go.
There you go.
You should listen to the History of England podcast. Right, okay, great. Who invited you, Lois, again? So the rotting teeth is a real problem, and they had a cure for it, which is you have a mixture of honey and human poo. So, I think I would suggest to you that you go and try this at home. Those are some, there are some other recipes about it, but those are the only health tips I can give you today. And I know you'll cherish them. So, let's end of that one.
Let's do the bar fight.
Okay, right, I'm going to pile. Who would you like by you in a bar fight?
So I thought deeply about this. I think real world experience in the hand-to-hand combat. For this, 2 contenders, thinking Richard Lionheart as a second place round. First, Edward Longshanks, because I've heard that the Longshanks actually might refer to his arms, and as anybody that's watched boxing knows, reach is an advantage. And this dude was tough as nails. Hammered Scott also took a look for a while. So I think I'd give it to Longshanks.
Ooh.
I think it's a great shout. She was on my list as well.
Yes.
Canoe. Have been beaten by the Vikings over and over and over. But I would take Canoe. Okay.
It's a good shout, though I have to say he did a pretty crap job with the water thing. Who are any other
bats?
Henry
Bolingbroke. Henry Bolingbroke actually put, you know, thoughts into action. He was one of the great, I believe, hand-to-hand combat champions of Europe before he was a king.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he would kick your ass.
he would certainly kick my ass. any other shouts? I say my vote, I'm going to cheat a little bit, and so I'm going to go, I think Longshanks is a great shout, I'm going to go for a king who was English, but wasn't necessarily king of the English. As you'll all know, because Richard and I both know it, the coolest place in England is in fact Mercia, the Midlands, and the guy you want by you in the bar when things get tough is Penda, king of Mercia. That is the guy, I mean there's nobody else can get close to him.
But was he English? Or was
he was English, yes.
He was a pagan.
No, he was a pagan, yeah. But he was Anglo-Saxon.
Okay.
Yeah.
Like that.
So my vote would go for Panda. What about your vote?
I'm going with the Napoleonic thought process of having a lucky general and not necessarily a talented one. I'm going for Henry V.
Oh.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I think I'd do that.
Yeah, he's a hard bastard, Henry.
He's young, you know, he's fighting gays. Yeah. I mean, we're obviously taking people in their prime at this, aren't we? You know,
obviously.
Yeah. And a second, you know, Henry Tudor as well, because anybody that can wash up on a Welsh beach and then become king, he's got to have.
That's true. That is true. To see him.
Yeah.
I did also think, actually, you know, so I was thinking we ought to be, you know, ought to be not too blokey about this. And actually, somebody I'd quite like to have by me in a bar brawl is Margaret Beaufort, because I think she'd probably take most people. I think she was pretty hard. So, you know, I might go for her as well. So, who would you like to go down the pub with, or indeed clubbing, if that, you know, whatever your poison is, Will?
Billy the Cock. You come in, with your lads and you exit as an owner of the pub.
Good point. Anybody else like who want to say coming with? Lois.
Richard the Second.
The Second.
He's got a word cosmos and be very sad.
Yes.
And talk about all those bastards who treat the second.
Yes. That is a good comment. I think it's
thinking about Edward the Third. Okay. When Nassalian, the Order of the Garter, took a drunken situation, makes it better. But everybody likes Team Mom around, having drinks. And also someone sounds like he did have a good time, but wouldn't be afraid of actually messing up like what you would with, say, Henry VIII. That whole part of the cloth gold sounded fantastic, but I'd be afraid to lose my head if it was wrong thing. So I'm going to go with Edward III, because he sounds like he'd have a good drink and turn a bad situation into a funny one.
So I was actually thinking about Richard the Lionhearted because he went to so many different places. I think he had a lot of great stories.
Okay,
all right.
Good
turn.
Go on.
My easy pick was Edward. Left his own coronation to make sweet love to Mother Diana. Just kicked out the guy who tried to fuss at him about it. Dunstan had to go to flank. But also was lesser known because they gave away more land to all his men. You know, take care of his boys who were with him at the pub. Gave away a lot of land. Edward's easy choice.
Choices?
Charles the Second.
Charles the Second.
Charles
the Second. Charles
the
This man knew what he was doing. Came off of Oliver Cromwell, right? What a fun time to have. Follow him up, he'd be a part of it.
Charles would steal all these girls, though.
Definitely Charles II. Because I want to know, like, I want to hang out with, like, cross-dresser who agrees to keep his pants on and not hit on me. And I want to hear what it was like, kind of before and after, you know, when he was hiding versus when he got asked to come back. And it just would be fun.
Okay. Excellent. It's quite interesting what people are looking for in their pub. So looking from the owner to the pub, essentially. Somebody who's going to give you lots of land afterwards. And somebody who's going to give you intelligent conversation. Is there a male-female split here? There's a certain sense of dignity in the male pub. Anyway, I'm just putting that out there. Anybody else? Okay, so I think I went for... George the Fourth.
Really?
Oh, come on, was it Prince Regent? He knew how to party.
Yeah.
He knew how to party. I mean, he really knew how to party. Anyway, he might be a bit of an arsehole, but he knew how to party. And he'd throw the money around.
Edit this podcast.
Sorry. Yes. He might be a bit of a... Anyway, next joke. Next question. What are we talking about next, Richard?
Okay, so I'll go back through some of the questions that you just skipped over.
Okay, let's do that.
Yeah, okay. Warrior Kings, David.
Warrior Kings.
When did they go out of fashion?
When did they go out of fashion?
Yeah.
So the last king to die in battle on English soil, English king, was who?
Richard.
You're very good. Richard III. And who was the last king to die on British soil? Dying battle. No, dying battle, sorry.
James.
Very good, James IV, in fact. That at the Battle of Flodden, 1513, when the Scots invaded England without any provocation. Okay? You know, I'm just putting that out there, just making that clear, you know, if you think, you know, poor old oppressed Scots. Anyway.
So we're beginning to sort of come to the conclusion of this now.
Right.
We'll have some what ifs, I think.
The what ifs, okay.
Shall we deal with these three reprobates as one?
Yes, we can have a vote on that. So do we think Henry Bolingbroke could have survived without rebelling? Richard II clearly hated him. Richard II had banished him to another country. Richard II had downgraded him in the view of the world, and that was extremely important to somebody as powerful as the Earl of Lancaster. But I'm not sure that Henry Bolingbroke was actually in
fear of death. And if that's the point of the question, that, you know, that they couldn't, they would have been killed, then I don't think Bolingbroke would have been killed, but he would be very much downgraded, and that was unacceptable to him. All those who think he could have survived without rebelling, raise their right hand in the air and say aye. There's a lot of punches, a lot of rebels in this room. Everybody who thinks he had to rebel in order to survive, raise their right hands. I think it's a draw, actually. What do you think?
I think he could have survived.
Sorry?
I think he did survive. That's a draw.
That's a draw? That's a draw. Okay, so we know nothing. So, good, well done. Well done.
You're welcome.
Don't mention it. So, the next one was...
Richard of York.
Richard of York. So, Richard of York, you remember the story. He puts his hand on the throne. Henry VI has had a terrible time, has been incompetent, has not managed the factions well. Richard of York has formed an alliance with the Nevilles and the Percys and is very worried indeed about the power of the Beauforts, who are very much favoured by Henry VI, and therefore Richard of York not only thinks that the king is incompetent, but he's also facing this faction which is in power and being favoured by Henry VI and Margaret of Anjou. So it's not just that he thinks Henry VI is incompetent, but that he also feels threatened by a faction. So he goes very famously to Parliament and he puts his hand on the throne to indicate that he should be king rather than just protector, and he gets a very negative reaction. You know, everybody says, what? I don't think so. So he goes back to York, war breaks out, he gets killed at the Battle of Wakefield. So should he have rebelled? So who thinks that he could not have survived? So Richard of York did not go battling in vain. Okay, we've got a result. Well done. Congratulations. And then finally...
Gloucester.
Richard of Gloucester. So in terms of going down the pub with somebody, somebody else said, I think at some point, they'd go down, I think it might have been you, Catherine, that they would go down the pub with Richard III to ask why.
I'd lubricate him first.
Right, okay. Give him a few pints.
Like getting pissed.
Yeah.
Saying why.
Right.
Going through why.
Get him pissed.
So characteristic of him.
And he'd say, well, the thing is, Catherine. He was like, I didn't like her. She was terrible. He had to die. He was a little git. Something like that. So there we are, Richard of Gloucester. He greets Edward V. They have won. York has won. There is no competitor in sight from Lancaster. Henry Tudor is a distant, distant fight, and even Margaret Beaufort has accepted the House of York as the rightful king at that point. It's only until Richard III comes along that she starts touting Henry, her son Henry, for the throne. So they've won. The ball is in the back of the net. It's 3-0, there's only 2 minutes to go. Yet he meets Edward V and his nephew, and he progressively takes their liberty away, at least, and I think, in my view, takes their lives, but that's a different question. And he has William Hastings, his ally, who thinks what he's done is appalling, summarily executed, as you may have seen on Tower in Tower Green when we went to the Tower of London. He was one of the ones who was taken out of a council meeting and had to take charge of. Why? Because, in theory, he was worried about competition from the rivers, the Woodvilles. And he thought that they were going to be out to get him, they would control Edward V rather than him, and they would strip him of power and possibly of his life. So, what do we think? Did Richard of York do the right thing? The only thing he could in the circumstances, and just got led progressively down to doing worse and worse and worse as he got dragged into it, or was he a plonker?
The non-plonker
option. So who thinks that Richard, let's put it simply then, who thinks that Richard III, in, you know, professional academic historical terms, was a plonker? Raise their hand. Who thinks Richard III was not a plonker? Okay, so I'm afraid the plonkers had it. Sorry, I mean the people who voted for plonker had it. No, not the people who were plonkers, you understand. I'm definitely with the plonkers. That's gone terribly wrong somehow.
So it was a lovely question from Catherine about what are the big moments in world history that changes the course of human history. Who would like to answer that? Catherine, would you like to answer that first?
So my favourite is probably the printing press, because I think it opened the world up for the lower classes to actually make decisions, to become educated, to make decisions for themselves and not be held to ransom by the church and the, you know, the upper echelon saying, this is what you must believe. But then they were open to having to read pamphlets, which was basically propaganda. But anyway, I would say the printing press, and I'm very grateful for the printing press because it gave me books. So.
Any other views?
Ice cream.
That's a great answer. Richard, what do you think? What changes event changes the course of human history?
Come on, you've had time, plenty of time to think about it. Had 2 seconds.
I like the way that you've ignored me all evening and now asked me a really difficult question. This is where I earn my wages. I'm going to sort of lead on from the printing press, actually. And although this is a very English-centric thing, I think the formation of the levellers and the true levellers movement within the New Model Army during the Civil War is monumentally overlooked in terms of its importance. Because if you look at the proclamation of the Free Peoples of England pamphlet that was written by Lilburn and co, it is that introduces common democracy to English politics. And from there, although I don't think it's an English creation, and obviously there are democracies of various different sorts, I think that for Western society is huge. And it was half a dozen blokes that were in an army, and they were really annoyed because they hadn't had their wages. And it just goes to show, just pay your staff. You know, because if you don't, you get revolution.
Excellent, that's a great answer. There's a chap called William Cobbett who said in, I think, 1826, I defy you to agitate a man on a full stomach.
Yes.
So, I mean, it's a good point. And who else?
Plague. Because that wiped out so many people that it changed the structure of, what's it called, the hierarchical...
Yes.
Tell me. I've had too many wines. Thank you, it changed feudalism. And I also believe it was one of the reasons why the church got so cracked down so hard on sex in a form that didn't create babies. Because if you had sex, didn't create babies, they were so worried about the fact that the population dropped that they were like hitting hard on people who didn't create babies because they wanted babies to build the population back up. So I think that had a long-standing effect on even today and till recently about how society views sex and relationships and even homosexuality and things. So that's.
Any other views?
No.
Carolyn?
I would say Martin Luther and the Protestant Reformation. I mean, as a Protestant and also as somebody whose ancestors came to America because of Puritanism and the Reformation, you know, he was an indentured servant. I'm not sure he really believed in that, but that's why he came, and so that's how I got here. So I.
Yeah.
Kind of in favor of that.
Yes, I agree. Anybody else? Right, should we call it a day, everybody? There are some things we want to do. Anybody have another question? Or do I wrap up at that point?
I have a question.
Caroline.
It's
kind
of unrelated to what we've been talking about, but related to British history. So I've also watched Time Team. And one of the things that impressed me about Time Team is the Romans were here and they had all these great things like hypercast top, tiles, and you did the Roman baths episode, and they had indoor plumbing and all this. And then as soon as they left, all that was kind of forgotten. And I never quite understood how it wasn't just built on, because they're saying the villas were still maintained over a certain time, but then it was just like all forgotten. Like, why did that happen?
I've got one go. Do you want to take this on? Or shall I have a go first and then you have a go?
Yeah. So you're right in saying that there was a maintenance that went on past the Roman occupation into what we now call the sub-Roman period as opposed to the Dark Ages. Largely, I mean, there is the general human phenomenon that technology gets lost as easy as it does become obtained. And there are many instances of this. You can see in this country and in France and places like that that we learn how to create steel and then we forget how to create steel for hundreds of years and go back to using iron and so on. And this is an example of that. What happens is the infrastructure that supported those farmsteads was vital to their upkeep and those towns. And when Roman administration left, it was the knowledge of administration that left with it. And so what happened is these vastly connected and well-supported areas, the complex urban and rural zones, became insular. And then the knowledge base contracted with the population contraction. And there wasn't an economy that was producing enough fuel. And there wasn't an economy that was producing manufactured pottery goods to maintain the hypocaust tiles or so, you know, whatever the different parts of it are. And so you have this sort of fracturing of the economy. And it's not as if they forget how to do it, they forget how to create the conditions for it to be done. And then, of course, all these horrible, you know, Germans and Scandinavians start turning up and robbing everything. They have other things to worry about, you know, and it rains a lot, and, you know, just... I think that kind of...
Yeah, comes up.
From an archaeological perspective, anyway, the historians often have very different views to us, because they don't work with data.
since I'm not a historian, you know that.
Oh, well, yeah.
Yes, I agree. I mean, the economy basically collapses around it. Yeah. It supports the infrastructure, and there's no reason for it anymore. People go back to their farms, and you know, you've got that lovely poem, haven't you, of the ruins, which, you know, the Anglo-Saxon poem, which goes into London, and he discovers these ruins, and it's a bit like Planet of the Apes, you know, with Charlton Heston, and he's in front of the Statue of Liberty, and he says, "Oh my God, you did it," sort of thing. And it's kind of like that, isn't it? You know, this ancient world that has completely gone, and it's just mystical because it's gone, being gone for 100 years. Any other questions? Thank you very much for your patience, everyone. And I'm sorry it turned into a slightly chaotic evening, but more than slightly, it was chaos. But I enjoyed it. I had a fun time. Thank you very much for your contribution, and it will be, hopefully, it will be appearing on a podcast near you, and you can hear, you know, how we got on. So thank you very much, and go and get some more food. Thank you.